News. I'm Sandhya Dirks in San Diego.
A wildfire in Southern California's inland mountains has expanded swiftly, burning homes and forcing evacuation of several small mountain communities. Captain Lucas Spellman of CAL FIRE says the rugged terrain presents one challenge, and there are others as well.
There's always wind in this area, so that just adds to the problems of the fire. So we have the fuels, the low humidities, and obviously the wind.
At last report, the fire was raging over 9-plus square miles with at least 3 people injured. Today, Muslims around the world begin celebrating the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. Sunrise prayers are followed by feasts to mark the end of Ramadan and the start of 3 days of Eid al-Fitr. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Walmart, where Forever stamps are sold at the register 7 days a week. Walmart sells Forever stamps.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. I'm Lisa Braltz in for Jim Meadows. Today on the show, I'm talking with Dr. Daphne Miller. She's the author of Pharmacology, What Innovative Family Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing, published recently by William Morrow. She's also the author of The Jungle Effect, a book describing her travels around the globe studying nutrition in traditional communities, part of her ongoing work exploring the frontier between biomedicine and the natural world. Her medical degree is from Harvard University, and in addition to being an author, she's a professor of family medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. Dr. Miller, welcome to Focus.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
Before we get started here with the interview, I want to let listeners know that this is a pre-recorded episode of Focus, so we're not taking phone calls this hour, but we definitely still want to hear from you. So you can comment about the show on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580, or you can post in the comment section of our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. So I'd like to start this conversation with your background. Can you describe your upbringing and how family farming played a part in your life as a child with your own family?
Well, literally from day one, I would say that I had exposures to farms. When I mean day one, I mean that I was conceived on a farm. My parents were actually part of the kibbutz movement in the 1960s, and they moved from the U.S. To Israel and were working on a kibbutz, picking peaches and raising chickens. And so I think that farming was probably part of my very early consciousness. And they actually tried to homestead at various times throughout my childhood. They bought land in upstate New York that they, at various points, moved up there and tried to make a go of it. For me, the true interest in farming probably happened because I am a physician, and I started to get very interested first in food and how to prescribe food for my patients, but then realizing that it was really how that food was grown that had everything to do with their health.
Doctors often have related interests outside their basic practice, but your area of interest really is not typical, it doesn't seem. It's not related to research around pharmaceuticals that's being done solely in a lab or in a school. It seems like you're more interested with talking in the boots on the ground in addition to the coats in the lab. What prompts a doctor to consider this particular connecting of the dots?
I think that if you take care of patients long enough in an 8x10 clinic, you realize that you don't have that many tools in your armamentarium. I mean, most of what ails us really has to do with our connections to our environment, be that the food that we eat or how we exercise or our relationships or the air that we breathe or the stress that we suffer at work. And these are things that we're not really taught to deal with the drugs and surgeries that we're given as our toolbox in medical school. And so just working with my patients has started to push me to look towards, real effective interventions that can help them stay healthy. And that is why I've spent a lot of time learning about the healing natures of food, and it's why I'm spending time now looking at farms as a resource for health.
So you had your patient base, so you were aware of a lot of the problems that your patients were having and how they were related to food and environment. So as you started to become interested in writing pharmacology, you must have been doing some sort of research with other books or other source materials. What were some of those materials that you found, and what sorts of insights did you gain?
From a whole variety of areas. Believe it or not, farming is actually written about in biomedical magazines. I'm not the first one to connect these dots, and it depends on, you know, which glasses you look on, put on when you're looking at the medical research. But there's lots of research even looking at things like biodiversity and its connection to health. But for me, what was one of the first inspirations probably was reading Wendell Berry, that philosopher, farmer, writer, and some of his work, really making very, very profound links between the health of the soil and the health of our body.
You write about an aha moment for you that came as a result of reading his work, while you were reading his work. Would you mind reading the passage from the preface in the book that seems to sort of crystallize the book, your book's premise?
Yes, and I think actually you're probably referring to two different things, because there was a book that I talk about called The Soul of Soil that was written by Grace Gershuni, which was actually one of the first books I discovered, and it really, it was a primer for gardeners, but it really, for me, I found it in the free box of a bookstore in San Francisco, and it read almost, for me, like a medical text. I started reading this, and I realized that the way that farmers treat their land, if they're doing it in a mindful and sustainable way, very much matches the way that doctors should be working with their patients around health in terms of connecting all these very complex issues. And I also realized that, in fact, the physiology of soil was very, very similar in some interesting ways to our own physiology, including the similarities of pH and the way that anatomically the layers are structured and so on. And, I mean, of course, it's not a perfect match, but very, very close. But that book is probably what got me started reading a lot of other books about the connections between farming and health. And I think what you are referring to is a trip that I took very early on to see Wendell Berry, because I realized that he was one of the philosophers thinking about this link. So I'm happy to read an excerpt to you about driving to see Wendell Berry. And in fact, this excerpt that I'm going to read to you takes place when I pull up next to his mailbox in Kentucky on Lane's Landing Farm. And this is what I was thinking. Several months earlier, I'd written a letter on cream-colored paper that must have ended up in this very same mailbox. I'd just finished reading The Unsettling of America, a book by writer, activist, and sixth-generation Kentucky farmer Wendell Berry. I left one particular chapter, The Body and the Earth, so riddled with notes and stars that I could barely read the original text. These two sentences were ones that I found especially inspiring. While we live and our bodies are moving particles of the earth, joined inextricably both to the soil and to the bodies of other living creatures. It is hardly surprising, then, that there should be some profound resemblances between our treatment of our bodies and the treatment of the earth. This was exactly what I was looking for, a farmer who'd given considerable thought to the links between agriculture and human health. I wrote to Mr. Berry immediately, introducing myself and asking if I might pay him a visit.
And he said?
He said yes.
He
wrote back
yes.
And said yes, because it turns out the reason I had to write on cream-colored paper to Wendell Berry is because certainly does not use email, and even phone lines don't seem to be something he has ready access to. So, yeah, our communication was pretty much by snail mail.
So what do you think it was about your letter that convinced him to agree to talk with you?
I think that he gets a lot of requests, you know, for visitors, for people really, you know, he's just a beloved and respected man. I think a lot of people would like to make the pilgrimage to meet Wendell Berry. But I think what stood out for him in my letter was that I was a physician who was interested in having this dialogue. And in fact, that is what he told me, that, you know, he really felt like he was wanting to have a conversation with a doctor about our mutual work and how interconnected it is.
So when he met you, when you showed up, when you turned up at his farm in Kentucky, what was his reaction to you when you met? And while you were talking, did he have any advice for you as you started out on this journey of writing your book?
Yes, I mean, all of the above. I mean, he was incredibly kind and gracious, and he gave me, you know, pretty much a whole day, which I just was so pleased and grateful for. But I visited him very, very early on in this project, and really the only thought I had in my mind was that it could be very valuable for me as a physician to begin to learn from farmers, and that spending time with them would both enhance my work as a doctor, but also perhaps lead to some profound insights for all of us about our health and our connections to nature and to the planet. And so I visited him very much with this open mind of, is this something worth pursuing, and if so, how? And by the end of my day with him, I really was very convinced that it was something worth pursuing and that I really should take time out of my practice to go and intern on farms and learn from farmers. And he also gave me a framework for how to do that.
I think he gave you a couple of questions that you asked yourself repeatedly as you visited the farms, which we'll get into those visits here in just a minute. But he gave you a couple of questions. What was here before you came, and what does nature help you do here? Was that the framework that you're talking about?
Yeah. As I was leaving his home at the end of the day, he did give me a series of questions that for him were the ways that he tended to approach things. And they're very logical questions, things like asking, and he really called on me to ask farmers to consult the genius of their place, is what he calls it, you know, referring to a quotation from Alexander Pope. But the idea was to ask farmers what was the land demanding of them? What was there before they came, and what did nature require of them? And what will nature help them do in terms of their work? And I think that these are very profound questions that, in fact, are ones that I really, you know, should have been asking my patients all along. I mean, so many times we try and change things within our health without really starting to consult our own bodies and figure out what is our body demanding of us, and what will it allow us to do, and what are its own healing properties.
So I think now is a good time to move into your visits to the farms that you describe in pharmacology, and the health concepts like rejuvenation and stress management, among others, as well as the patient anecdotes that go with each of your stories. And in these stories, you also talk with scientists about related research. So I'm curious, did you visit each place with a concept in mind first, or did those concepts evolve as you participated in each visit?
It really, for me, was a very open exploration, as close as I could get to, you know, my own personal experiment. So the way I chose the farms was by looking for farmers who were doing interesting things and that I found were compelling, and also looking for farmers who are farming in a sustainable way. But the lessons that I derived from each visit were ones that really came to me from being there. I didn't go into any of this with a preconceived notion. And in fact, there were other farms that I went to that I don't include in the book, but, you know, because they didn't really offer as, you know, as strong a lesson. Mm-hmm.
I did find it very interesting that none of the farms that you visited were what I would call the usual suspects, and I'm making air quotes there, names in family farming and agriculture that have become much better known in the last 10 years because of so much literature out there about family farming. You know, Michael Pollan writing about Joel Salatin, for example, sort of made him into a rock star in farming. And so was that intentional to try and stay away from some of these farms that have become better known over the last decade or so?
Well, to be honest with you, I wasn't thinking along those lines, but I was really trying to find farmers who were incredibly innovative and incredibly fresh in the way that they were thinking. And it turns out that most of those farmers are ones who are really not celebrity farmers. They're ones who are just on the earth doing their work.
Exactly. So the first place that you talk about visiting in your book is Jubilee Biodynamic Farm in Washington State. Can you define biodynamic agriculture for our listeners, and how it's different from, say, organic agriculture?
Biodynamics is an idea that started with Rudolf Steiner in the early 19th century, but it really has come to, you know, encompass the idea, like many other forms of sustainable farming, that you recycle all your resources back into the earth and really keep the resources on the farm so that they regenerate the farm. Everything from the, you know, the animal manure to seeds to water and so on. But within biodynamics, there's also the idea that you can use different herbs, for pesticides and also for fertilizer. And there's complicated ideas about using things that are a little more esoteric, like using the zodiac or the signs of the moon to dictate your harvest behavior. And I would be lying to you if I said that I was an expert in the full true meaning of biodynamics. But as far as I can understand it, it really is just another way of respecting the regenerative power of nature and really using that as the model for farming rather than thinking that you need a lot of external inputs to the land.
So even though in biodynamic agriculture you can plant the steer's horn during the full moon in a certain constellation or whatever, there's also the use of science as well. While you were at Jubilee, the farmer Eric gives you a folder full of lab test results to look at, and your doctor mind just takes over. Can you describe what he was showing you and then maybe how that led to your thinking about a particular patient of yours in your practice?
Yeah, and just to clarify, there is a lot of science actually now supporting biodynamics, but what Eric, that doctor, the farmer that you're describing, who is now a biodynamic farmer, when he was looking at those lab tests, he was not a biodynamic farmer.
Okay.
That was before he became one. When he discovered that his soil was in really poor condition, he put a tremendous amount of effort into trying to rejuvenate the land, but he did it in a very traditionally, you know, sort of a non-biodynamic or non-organic way, which was to test the land and to send the soil samples to the lab and then to buy a lot of external inputs, a lot of external minerals, and dump them on the soil and work them into the soil in the hopes of rejuvenating his soil. But what he found was that over time, by doing this, his soil really wasn't getting that much healthier, that he was spending thousands of dollars, and that his fruits and vegetables weren't really looking like they had that much more nutritional punch.
Mm-hmm.
So it was with that realization that he switched to biodynamics and stopped buying all the external inputs that probably many of which come from minerals that are extracted from other countries and so on, and started to really just use the resources of his land and figure out how to compost and how to regenerate the soil by recycling everything and how to conserve water. And he started to use more indigenous seeds and started to use ground covers and perennials and mixed crops and all these things. And as a result, he was able to repeat those lab tests, those soil tests, and realized that his soil was now much healthier than when he was buying the external inputs. And for me, the lesson that I extracted from that was that so often in medicine, I see patients who are trying to get healthy by buying a lot of supplements and mm-hmm. going on a lot of medications to sort of rebalance their labs, when in fact, maybe what we should start to explore is how much health can we get by becoming part of one of these regenerative cycles ourselves. I mean, after all, if it benefits the animals on the land and the soil and the plants, there is every reason to suggest that this kind of process will also make us healthier if we eat from that land and give back to that land.
So you had a patient in mind, and you talk about her in the book, and where her body was sort of, as you said, very similar to the land before Eric decided to pursue biodynamics. And so what was her outcome?
Of course, this is just a case of one, mm-hmm. although I must say in my practice I've seen this story unfold many times. But with her, what was so interesting was that she came to see me in a very depleted state, very much like Eric's soil had been when he took it over. And she also came into her first appointment with two huge bags filled with supplements and also some pharmaceuticals, many of them prescribed by other practitioners in response to an abnormal lab test. And despite taking all these, she really was not feeling much better. She had a lot of symptoms of depletion. Her digestion wasn't working. She had depression. She was gaining weight. She was incredibly fatigued. And she kind of discovered that with each new supplement, she would feel better for a couple days and then go back to her not-so-good baseline. And so when I told her the story about Eric and suggested that she herself try and connect to one of these healthy farm cycles and start to peel back all the external inputs, so to speak, she was actually quite open to the idea. I mean, surprisingly open. And so what first for her started as an experiment of just buying one of those CSA boxes and starting to eat from that rather than eating from Costco and eating stuff out of packages, soon turned to a much deeper involvement for her with farming. She started to volunteer on an urban farm and started to work in a school that had a farming program and started to make more social connections around farming. And she got better. And this is not a scientifically controlled experiment. I can't tell you what finally normalized her labs right. without all the inputs and what improved her mood and helped her lose weight. I mean, was it eating the food? Was it the social connection? But certainly there was something about her joining this cycle that was healing.
I'm Lisa Braltz, and you're listening to Focus on WILL. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be right back with Dr. Daphne Miller. She's the author of the book Pharmacology and is talking with us this hour about the connections between farming and health. Stay with us.
Hi, welcome to the law offices of Saul Goodman and Associates. From parking tickets to mass murder, from slip and fall to bond fraud. Saul Goodman and Associates.
That's the character Saul Goodman, the sleazy lawyer from Breaking Bad, which returns Sunday. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Bob Odenkirk about playing Saul. Better Call Saul on the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from WGLT in Bloomington, presenting their final recycled music sale, Friday and Saturday, August 16th and 17th, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., and Sunday, August 18th, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., at the Crossroads Center, Wiley Drive in Normal. More information is at WGLT.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. I'm Lisa Brawl. I'm Lisa Brawls, and you're listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. This hour, I'm talking with Dr. Daphne Miller. She studies the connection between farming and health and recently published the book Pharmacology, What Innovative Family Farming Can Teach Us About Health. Daphne, before the break, we were talking about the first farm you visited in writing the book, and the second farm you visited kind of puts the lie to the stereotype that healthy living is in the province of hippies and the far left. You visited a rancher who had been using conventional methods to raise beef, but then went in a different direction. Can you tell me more about him?
Yeah, well, you are absolutely right. Cody Holmes is anything but a hippie. and he actually seemed to have a fair amount of disdain for the hippie lifestyle. But he is a very much a sustainable farmer and actually calls himself a holistic rancher, which I thought was so interesting. And what originally motivated Cody, there was two things that motivated him. One was finances, and the second was love for his family. And he was a very traditional beef farmer who, you know, was injecting hormones and antibiotics into his beef and growing them and raising them very much in these confined lots. But what happened, what he started to notice was whenever it came time to raise his beef, he was always keeping one of them out on pasture and not subjecting it to the same kind of treatments, the same kind of chemical treatments that he was subjecting all the rest of his beef to. And that was the cow that he would feed to his own children. And so he realized that there was a double standard going on there. And then what really motivated him was realizing that he could no longer survive as a rancher because he was spending so much on, right, on fertilizers to grow his corn, to buy corn when he didn't grow enough, to buy the antibiotics, to buy the hormones, and so on. And to buy milk for the calves, even, because he wasn't even feeding the calves their mother's milk. And so he realized that he only had one choice, and that was to do away with all these external inputs. And that ended up changing his whole system of farming. And what he swiftly realized was that not only was he able to all of a sudden have a lucrative business as opposed to a money-losing one, but that his beef cattle were much, much healthier. He wasn't seeing all the diseases that he had been seeing when he was raising them on, you know, using external inputs. And so this was the part that intrigued me, because I have long been interested in the research showing that children raised on sustainable farms tend to have less asthma and allergy and be overall more resilient. And here he was finding the same thing with his cows. And so I wanted to find out why. Why is this going on?
And you did visit his farm. And speaking of the research about children being raised on farms and their health, you did visit a researcher in Germany whose work centers around that. So how did her research relate to what you had discovered while you were there at the farm?
It was all interconnected, and basically what she had found was that children who are raised on sustainable farms are probably getting exposed to low levels but important allergens and bacteria and microbes, you know, the various fungi, from very, very early on, that are sort of priming their immune system so that it can actually know when to respond to dangerous bacteria and when to not respond to it, which is in essence what allergies and asthma are, an overreaction to our response to the natural world. And so by being raised on these farms, these children were able to have immune systems that were just much more appropriate in their response.
Mm-hmm. So going back to your time on the farm, there's an episode in the story where you are confronted with a glass of raw milk and your doctor mind very temporarily takes over. Can you talk about that? Was it difficult, even though you were interested and open to learning, to overcome any fears or preconceived notions you had about raw milk and food safety and things like that?
Absolutely. I mean, as I explain in the book, I'd actually grown up drinking raw milk because my parents did spend time homesteading on these farms in upstate New York, and we would get raw milk from the neighbors, and I loved it and never thought twice about drinking it. But in the intervening years, I'd spent a lot of time in medical school and in research labs and in emergency rooms and so on, and really had developed a pretty serious fear of drinking things that were unpasteurized. And so when I was on Cody's farm and was offered this glass, this beautiful glass of raw milk, I really did hesitate. And I would say with good reason. I mean, if dairy products of any kind are contaminated, then the only thing that keeps that contamination from taking a stronghold and really just growing exponentially is pasteurization, you know, boiling that milk. And so that was very much on my mind. But what I talk about in the book is trying to understand objectively, to understand raw milk objectively, so to understand its upsides and its downsides. And in that process of pasteurization, we're actually losing a lot of healing qualities of the milk as well. And so I try and really give this balanced picture of how, you know, what are some ways that we can retain that and yet not just, you know, full-heartedly think that any milk that is raw is going to be good for us.
Right. You did mention in the book, too, I mean, and you tried the milk. We should let our listeners know that you drank the milk and it was good and everything was fine and you felt great. But you also knew the source. You knew where it was from. And that's something that you talk about in the book with this particular story is knowing the source and being able to get it really fresh is really important.
And actually, the analogy that I make in the book is that I don't think it's that different from unprotected sex. You know, you're going to do it with someone who you really understand, you know, where they've been, and you trust them very much and understand how they're caring for themselves. And raw milk is kind of the same way. You want to know who that farmer is. You want to know when that milk was gathered, hopefully, you know, within that day. And, you know, how the cow was treated and the health of the cow and so on. And, it definitely has some tremendous upsides, but you have to know where it's coming from.
So moving on to the next farm that you talk about, you actually visited a pair of egg farms in Arkansas, and you related those visits to possibilities for stress management in humans. So what did you see at those farms, and how did what you saw relate to two patients of yours named Mike and Carl?
That experience really taught me a lot about health on many different levels. On a very basic level, I learned the difference between what free-range organic means on your egg carton versus pasture-raised, which was something that I had not understood before. And then on another level, I understood that the distinction between those two farming styles really translated into sort of a low-grade, chronic stress versus, on the other extreme, a kind of stress that actually can be very, very healthy or even productive rather than illness-causing, which is what I associate low-grade chronic stress with.
I'm going to move along into the next farm, actually. In your chapter about a visit to Scribe Winery in California, You don't talk about preventing cancer, which is something when I see a book like the one you wrote, or when people see that, they often expect to be told how to prevent cancer, all these things that they're supposed to do in order to not get it. But you don't really talk about preventing cancer as much as you talk about our current approach to treating cancer, or in the case of the patient you describe in the book, the management of a precancerous condition. How was the winery's approach to pests relative to how we can manage cancer or precancer?
This was a bit of a different chapter for me because the story that I tell here is about these cancer researchers who are actually looking at models of integrated pest management, which is this kind of holistic way of managing pests, and they're trying to apply these models to cancer care. And what the traditional way of dealing with cancer is to think of it as something that needs to be eradicated. We either nuke it out or burn it out or, you know, cut it out, blast it out.
There's all these very violent words used to describe how to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. And what sustainable farmers have realized is that when they take that approach to pests, that they are probably doing more harm than good, that the pesticides and herbicides that are needed in order to completely eradicate a pest are going to actually hurt the soil, they're going to hurt the plant, they're going to hurt the entire ecology of the farm. And so they take a much more gentle and sort of balanced and ecological approach and really think about how can they nurture the healthy parts of the farm so that they stay in balance with parts that are perhaps more invasive or less healthy. And how can they actually maintain the overall balance of the place, maybe even acknowledging that the pests, the things that they think are bad, might have a positive role in the larger environment and might not just be negative. And so these cancer researchers are taking a page out of these farmers' books and starting to think of cancer that way. Perhaps it isn't just the overarching foe that we've thought of. Are there actually attributes of cancer cells that have evolved because they are in some ways beneficial? How do we recognize those? How do we foster those? And how, most importantly, do we keep the rest of the human organism and the human cells healthy so that they can counterbalance these cancer cells and keep them at bay? And so this is a very new way of thinking. It's actually quite radical for medicine. And yet it is taking hold, and it's something that many people who are in the cancer world are starting to talk about, this ecological approach to cancer management.
You use a phrase, walking the field, in the book. What does that mean?
Yes. So I spent time on this vineyard, which is being managed in this very sustainable way, with an integrated pest management expert, and his name was Jeff Wheeler. And what Jeff explained to me, he said that the key thing about doing this kind of pest management is that it has to be very personalized. It has to be very individualized. So, you know, in his words, you can't sit in your pickup truck and manage that field from behind a computer, which is how a lot of farmers who are more conventional do manage their pet fields, you know, mm-hmm. Spray X amounts of pesticides this week, do that, and so on. He said, what I have to do is I have to get out of the truck and walk up and down each row of the vineyard and assess what's going on amidst the vines and look at the populations of bugs that are there and how they're interacting and the other factors such as dust and the number of weeds and moisture and the health of the vine, and all of these things play a role in how he's going to maintain a healthy balance within the vineyard. And I was listening to him and realizing that within medicine, what is constraining us is very much this same obstacle that many physicians don't want to, you know, get out there and walk the field and really understand what is going on within each patient and what their natural balance is. And what I referred to at the beginning of the interview about Wendell Berry's guiding questions, where he said, really ask what is being asked of us. What I've noticed is with each patient, the balance is different. Mm-hmm. The demands are different. And so you really do need to kind of walk that field and find out what that person needs in order to maintain health. And within oncology in particular, you know, that means assessing a lot of different things, like the pH of the healthy cells and what the diet for that person is and their stress level and their level of sleep, their, you know, the quality of their sleep and how much they exercise. All of these things are going to contribute to their ecology and predict how they are going to respond to a cancer.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about community farming and urban farming, getting from the rural to the urban. You visit an urban farm called La Familia Verde in the Bronx in New York. That's also a farm stand. Community gardens are very popular now. We've seen them in our area popping up all over town, especially in the last 5 to 10 years. What are the health payoffs to community gardening and farming? What did you discover there?
What I discovered in the Bronx was really, for me, a very profound public health lesson, in that I had always thought of urban farming as obviously a good thing, and I thought of it as a good thing because it grew more vegetables in an area where otherwise there might not be access to fresh vegetables. But what I learned in the Bronx, and by spending time with really this leader in urban farming, a woman named Karen Washington, was that urban farming affects the health of the community in way more ways than just as a source of good vegetables. That, in fact, public health researchers are discovering that it does everything from improve school performance to decrease crime rates to decrease rates of dementia amongst seniors to decreasing alcoholism rates. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a great source of a local economy, which is directly linked back to health. So it really thinking of these urban farms as a very powerful public health intervention, just as powerful as, you know, bringing in a smoking cessation program or an exercise program or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And it's a very different environment than the one at Rockin' H, but it sounded like it would be very beneficial to children also, especially with adults modeling good behavior for kids.
These things are always intergenerational, and I really can't think of anything that connects a family more in an urban or rural setting than gardening and farming. I really can't.
I'm curious how your colleagues in the field, other physicians, how do they perceive your work? We spoke earlier about how these sorts of things were not taught to you in medical school, and I'm not sure that they're actually taught now. So when you're out talking about these sorts of things to your colleagues, how do they see that, and what's their reaction?
Well, I think it helps that I have spent a lot of years, you know, studying medicine, and that I trained at a reputable institution, just in terms of, and that I have a background in research myself. But I would be lying to you if I said that this, you know, these ideas are, you know, just at the fore of what my colleagues are thinking about. And yet I find that there is a certain openness now that wasn't there 10 years ago. I think that medicine can no longer stand to think of itself as isolated from the rest of the natural world, and that the human body is, you know, this island. It's just undeniable that how connected we are to nature, and that it is only by beginning to explore these connections that we have any choice of surviving in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the questions like how the loss of biodiversity will affect human health are no longer abstractions. I mean, we've seen how that is manifesting itself in, you know, the loss of food, in the loss of healthy air, and the increase in cancers because our planet can no longer, you know, protect us from toxins. And so these are things that are becoming very, very paramount as we start to think about how we can continue to stay healthy and how, you know, we can survive as a species. And so I think that doctors are open to this and are really embracing these ideas. And I have been asked to speak in a number of medical institutions and to give grand rounds, which is kind of like the high mass in medicine, on the connections between farming and health. And I do feel like there really is a shift going on.
Do you feel that shift also extends to patients? You know, my question is, do you think patients would trust their doctors more if more consideration was given to more holistic ideas or less? I mean, I think some people, as patients, do want a doctor to go in and nuke it or just give me a pill or whatever. So do you feel like patients are starting to become a little more trusting of that as well?
I think that actually many patients are demanding it. And that's where this all starts, in fact. And I write about this in the last chapter of the book, that it is all of us that are going to guide this new way of thinking about our health, and that we're going to expect this of our health providers, that they no longer atomize us and think of us as just, you know, organs or cells or strands of DNA, but that we really are thought of as a complex living organism that's connected with many other complex living organisms in a big ecology, and that it's by thinking in that way that we're really going to start to make some big inroads into the largest problems that plague us now, like obesity and these escalating rates of diabetes and escalating rates of many cancers and so on.
And that brings me to a question about access and cost. Organic or biodynamic food, beauty products, things of that nature are often seen as the province of the well-off. People really do feel pressured to do it all. I think, you know, I talked to some friends who are like, well, I can't afford organic food, so who cares? I'm not even going to bother going to the farmer's market, or I'm not going to try to grow anything myself or whatever. So what is your advice for people of more modest means who are interested in these approaches but feel like they can't do it? It's not accessible to them.
In fact, probably growing your own food is the most affordable way to get food. And that's the first thing that I really want to underline, that, you know, there, and it's amazing how much you can produce in a very small space. I mean, we have a project here in California where a lot of it's happening on balconies in low-income communities and, you know, growing a lot of the essential herbs and so on. And, in fact, when you grow healthy fruits and vegetables, you get a much bigger bang per bite. And so just even having a couple pots of herbs can contribute a huge amount to, you know, the overall antioxidant content of your diet and so on. So any effort, no matter how small, is important. But this choice that we talk about in terms of, oh, how it's cheaper to go and buy the white bread or cheaper to buy the commercially mass-produced food items, is really a false choice. What that choice is between the dollar that's in your pocket, you know, it relates to the dollar that's in your pocket and where you're going to spend it that day. But when we start to factor in a lot of other things, like the cost of treating the diabetes that stems from eating that white bread and so on, then all of a sudden it really is a false choice, because that white bread is way, way, way more costly than that fruit and vegetable. And that is not so much a problem for each individual as for us as a country. We need to understand that trade-off and start to look at the real dollar value of the foods that we give ourselves access to and start to shift the equation, because in truth, the fruits and vegetables are much, much cheaper in the long run. And so, and that's something that we all need to recognize and participate in. But I really encourage each community to start to try and figure out how to take care of themselves. And that is what is happening in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. That's what's happening in many rural parts of this country. And it's amazing when we band together as a group, as a community, how much healthy stuff we can grow if we put our mind to it.
I do feel like culturally in the United States, we have a collective bad self-esteem in some ways. We all say we love food and people have to eat. We got to eat. But we seem to be very attached as a culture to some bad habits, regardless of income level. But we feel helpless to change them, or we don't want to, even when we know they're not good for us. So what do you think has to happen culturally? And you touched on this a little bit in the previous question. But what do you think has to happen culturally for better health in our country, both for humans and the environment?
I think that cooking and connecting to growing are really the key, because I work a lot with children in my practice. And I see that when kids have touched the soil and seen where a fruit and vegetable comes from and pulled it out of the soil, it doesn't matter if it's a spicy daikon radish or sweet carrot, they're going to find it way more delicious. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, somehow being connected to the growing cycle is the first piece. And then cooking is the second part. When we actually start to make our own foods, then we become much more interested in the ingredients. We don't just treat it as a box of mystery food. And, you know, those are kind of tall orders for a country that, you know, spends 4 or 5 hours a day on average watching TV and 2 hours a day in a car. And,
sure.
You know, mm-hmm. And so on. So we're going to have to rethink some of those things, because it's very hard to cook or grow vegetables when you're watching TV or driving.
Or working. Two jobs or whatever.
Actually, the truth is that, you know, if you look at the numbers across income levels, working is in many ways less of a constraint, but work as well.
Well, there's a lot more that I'd like to ask you. I feel like actually every farm you visited would be its own in-depth interview, but that is all we have time for today. So, Dr. Daphne Miller, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
I'm Lisa Braltz, and this hour on Focus, I've been talking with Dr. Daphne Miller. She's author of the new book, Pharmacology, What Innovative Family Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing. You can find out more about her book on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Focus is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. This is Focus on WILL AM 580. Thanks for joining us.
Agricultural market reports on WILL are made possible with support from Busey. Small business is the next big business. So Busey offers solutions to fit growing business needs, from customizable lending options to succession planning. Busey, your dream, our promise.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. This is Illinois Public Media. Here's an update of what the trade looks like in Chicago from the CME Group at this hour. Corn futures are up 4.25 cents at $4.72.5. The December at $4.60, up a penny and a half. And the March corn at $4.73.25, 1.75 cents higher. The May contract there at $4.81, a penny and a half higher. The soft red winter wheat trading September at $6.41.25. That's the lead option, down 2.25. December at $6.53.5. 2.75 cents lower as well. August soybean futures at $13.44.75 are up 17 cents. September at $12.19.75, up 20.75. And November beans $11.80.5, 14.75 cents higher. January futures at $11.85.75, up 13.5. And the July of next year trading at $11.92, up 9.75. Bean meal up $16.50 at $416.80 a ton. Bean oil at $41.72, that's 8 cents cents higher for the day. August live cattle at 122.77 and a half, $1.55 higher. October futures at 126.55, $1.87 and a half higher. August futures at 153.35 or 77 and a half cents higher for the day. The September up 95 at 157.32 and a half, and lean hogs at $100.62 and a half cents or up 40 cents. October at 85.17 and a half. are 25 cents higher. You, of course, are listening to Illinois Public Media. This is WILL AM 580 and WILL FM 90.9 HD3 Urbana. I'm UofI Extension's Todd Gleason.